From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Will racism ever be eradicated?
That's quite racialist, to be honest.
Racist, not racialist.
You're racialist. What's going on here? You're chucking me out because of the color of my skin.
Today, I talk with the author of a book that chronicles the history of racial ideas from the birth of our nation to present day. However you define racism, Linda Long of Atlanta says it is alive and well today.
Some people still think that dark is bad. If you're bright, you're going to get ahead. And I think it still happens. You can get apartments and cars faster than someone of color. If you're bright skin, you can get a better apartment than the one that's dark skin. You may be discriminated against and not get that apartment.
More on the evolution of racism later. First, though, we talked on Friday about the use of corporal punishment in schools. It's something that still happens in Georgia. Georgetown University professor Rebecca Ryan says at home, more parents are choosing not to spank their kids.
Parents are just figuring out other things to do rather than spank their children. They're being given options. And they're taking those options, perhaps because they feel like those options are more effective.
That segment sparked a lot of conversation from you guys. Andrea from Hawkinsville, Georgia, left us this comment.
I believe that hands are meant for loving and not for hurting. Although I believe in corporal punishment up until a certain age, perhaps 11, I've used wooden spoons. But I don't believe in spanking your children. I would prefer timeouts or writing sentences.
On Twitter, Carrie Howell wrote, quote, corporal punishment is archaic and degrading. We want our children to respect us, not resent us, end quote. And Dina from Athens, Georgia, called to say there's never any situation in which corporal punishment is appropriate.
I have a close relative who was actually whipped for missing spelling words when he was in elementary school in the state of Georgia. And turns out later he was ADHD. You can't punish that out of kids. I don't think it's helpful. I think it actually causes more problems than it solves.
We love hearing these comments from you guys. You can call us like Andrea and Dina did. It's 404-500-9457. You can post to Facebook or find us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. For half a century, students in North Georgia have been recording and preserving the folk culture of the Appalachians. The magazine Foxfire was established in 1966 to help prevent those stories, music, and crafts from going extinct. This year marks Foxfire's 50th anniversary, and the University of Georgia will present some of that work in a new exhibit. Joining me from Athens is Mary Miller. She's a Peabody Awards collection archivist at UGA. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for having us on.
It's a pleasure. Also joining us is UGA student Kimberly Ellis, who worked on this exhibition. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Oh, so Mary, is there a kind of an identifiable, definable Appalachian culture?
You know, Celeste, I think it's a hybrid of a lot of things. It's a lot of European traditions that were brought over and then took root in a geographically rather inaccessible area. And I think it did kind of become its own thing over the course of time.
So let's listen to a little bit of the archives. This is Tedra Harmon playing a banjo that he made himself, and he's performing an old song called Sourwood Mountain.
I'm going to see if we can play a little Sourwood Mountain for you. Old hammer leg.
Kimberly, out of 50 years of material, how did you decide, as a group, what to feature and what not?
Well, me and my co-curator, Dixie Gallops, what we did was we really looked at the past 50 years and focusing on the first 20 years, and we kind of picked up themes throughout. And one of the most loud themes that we heard was the ingenuity and the resourcefulness of the mountain elders. So we really picked things that we could pair with actual artifacts found in Mountain City at the Heritage Center.
What kind of artifacts, Mary, are in the exhibit?
Oh, there's some wonderful things. There's a butter churn, there's a still, there's a coverlet that was made by Aunt Airy, who's one of the most popular, I would say, Foxfire figures. She's found in a number of the books and just a really joyful soul. There's brooms, there's baskets, there's a corn shuck mop, there's dolls. Kimberly, what am I leaving out?
Well, you're actually leaving out Tedra Harmon's banjo that we heard in the very beginning.
Yes, of course.
His fretless banjo
that he
actually made in 1974. And we actually have the banjo that he made in the magazine.
And you mentioned Aunt Erie. Here she is actually speaking to students about corn shucking.
Then they come in and chuck the corn, sing and have the best time. You've never seen such a good time as they had corn shucking, you know. I wish you could go corn shucking one time.
Oh, I wish I could.
I do too. If we had like we used to, we'd have everybody you always come down here. We'd have the best time. Then they shuck the corn, and when they get the corn shucked, if it got done, and then you're always finished before you left.
Can you tell me, Kimberly, a little bit about Aunt Erie and what made her so popular?
Aunt Erie really made the children proud of where they came from. And a lot of the things that I picked up from her reading, I actually have my favorite quote of hers, which is, "Everything that grows was put here for a reason, and our job's to find out what it's here for." So she was really inspirational to me as far as looking around you and kind of thinking how you can use the materials to create everyday objects.
I'm speaking with UGA student Kimberly Ellis. She contributed to a current exhibition that showcases the culture of the Appalachians, and also with us is talking about Foxfire is archivist Mary Miller. And the culture of the Appalachians, Mary, people say is endangered. Why is that?
Well, I think that modernity makes it harder to hold to the old ways, or perhaps makes them seem a little less relevant. You know, if you can jump in the car and get to the dollar store and buy a broom and be back home in less time than it would take you to make one, the impetus to make one seems to have diminished. But I think what Kimberly and Dixie did such an excellent job of, and what Kimberly just alluded to, is the spirit of resourcefulness, more than the idea that it's better to make a room than buy a broom, the idea that you can take care of yourself, that you don't rely on others and external sources, and that you're able also, and you're not wasteful, that you'll take the things that you have, like corn shucks, and turn them into a doll or a broom or a mop or a basket or a chair seat or something useful rather than just tossing them out the door.
You know, for those, Kimberly, who have never heard of Foxfire, and Foxfire started in the 1960s, we've mentioned it's 50 years old, and really took off. It became sort of a national phenomenon. But for those who haven't heard of Foxfire, can you explain what this magazine is?
I can explain that just because before I started working on the exhibit, I had actually never heard of it. I'm from Philadelphia, not saying that people in Philadelphia don't read Foxfire, but it was a little bit foreign to me. Really, what it is about students going out and looking to their elders to learn both the tangible and the intangible. In our exhibit, we talked about the intangible a lot also, which is the collection of stories, social customs, events, oral expressions. Booger Tales was one of my favorites, which was ghost stories found. And without this magazine, those kind of things really do die with time. So this was a really important part of cultural journalism for North Georgia.
And for you, Mary, the Foxfire represents a really successful teaching tool, right? I mean, this began as a way to engage students, and it's survived 50 years because it's somehow fed into something that maybe other student projects or educational opportunities don't. Why?
Right.
How? What
happened?
Celeste,
I think there's, you know, these are my hypotheses. This is not necessarily factual, but I do think it was a couple of things. One, the students got to pick their own project. So right there, you had student buy-in. It wasn't handed down from the teacher. He tried a number of things and finally kind of said, okay, what do you all want to do? And they decided to do the magazine. So that's one thing. Another thing was that it was for a broader audience than the teacher. So it was authentic. If you know that people you've never even met might be reading your words, you'll craft them more carefully than you will for just another assignment that you're going to hand in and the teacher's going to read, and that's going to be all there is to it. And both of those things, and then the third thing, a third thread is the tie to place, that it was really looking at their roots and where they came from and turning their attention back and in a way finding the great value in the traditions that they came from and saying, you know, everything that's wise isn't in a book. Here's wisdom out here that you all can gather up. And the place-based, student-led, broader audience are all part of the things that are the Foxfire core principles today. I mean, having Dixie and Kimberly do the exhibits is in itself a, in keeping with the Foxfire tradition, a form of experiential learning where they take the things that they've learned, say, in their site interpretation class and then actually apply them to create an exhibit.
So then Kimberly, coming to this fresh, having never heard of Foxfire before, and knowing that if I can buy a pound of butter for a couple bucks at Publix, I'm probably not going to churn it for myself most of the time. But what lasts? If it's not making things from scratch, which most people will do, what do you take away from Foxfire that you think is still relevant and resonant?
I mean, I think exactly what you just said. I mean, I think that the direct connection to the processes and the materials, you see that a little bit. Foxfire started during the kind of the Back to the Land movement, and this is kind of a resurgence, especially here in Athens and other big cities. So I do think that that message that started in the 60s with the advent of Foxfire has really lasted today, and people are taking pride of ownership of the things that they've made and the satisfaction of construction of what they've made, and also the convenience of the long use, and things just tend to last more, maybe because you care about them more, because you spent so much time.
And Mary, what is the Foxfire, what has that actually meant for the people whose traditions have been documented? How important has it been for the people of North Georgia and the Appalachians?
Oh, I think it's been hugely important. Foxfire never would have succeeded in the first place. The magazine would have failed if the folks that the students went out to talk to wouldn't have talked to them. It's validating to have your story told. And the fact that it went beyond, you know, Northeast Georgia and became, you know, the Foxfire books, when the magazines were published into books, they became bestsellers. So it really, it recognized the value of those people and their lives and what they've done. Traditionally, kind of the rural poor tend to be marginalized and viewed perhaps as not knowing as much or not having as much. And to see the great traditions that they had, and even, you know, as you said, even if folks aren't churning their own butter, at least they have a connection to people who did, and they know that if they had to, it would be possible to do it.
And we just got this email from GPB's own Grant Blankenship, who says, my grandmother and aunt had all the books when I was growing up. This was growing up in Southeast Tennessee. Reporting up in Rabun County in the early aughts, we were hanging with the Foxfire folks. They told a story about how one young person who was collecting an oral history on how to do some handiwork, like make a fiddle, asked the informant where they learned the craft. The informant said, they learned it from a Foxfire book. And I love that from the perpetuation of tradition standpoint. I want to say thank you to Peabody Awards Collection archivist Mary Miller. She oversaw a new exhibition at UGA documenting folk culture in North Georgia. The program is called Foxfire, celebrating its 50th anniversary, and it's open to the public until this Friday, December 16th, so rush out. Also with me was Kimberly Ellis, a student who worked and curated the exhibition. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Celeste. We appreciate it.
From its earliest days as a nation, the U.S. has struggled with a problem that we can't seem to solve. Racism. It's at the foundation of many of our institutional policies. And Ibram Kendi chronicles the evolution of racial ideas in his book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. The book recently won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. And Ibram will speak tonight at the Atlanta History Center. But first, joins me now by Skype from his home in Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's really a pleasure to talk to you because this book, it's very difficult to read a book these days on racism that says new things, but you seem to do it all the way through the whole book. And let's start with the first, the most essential thing, which is your use of racial ideas instead of saying it's a history of racism. What's the difference?
Well, I wanted to distinguish between the ideology of racism. So somebody thinking, for instance, that Black people are lazy, and the praxis of racism, or the practice, which is somebody discriminating, let's say, against a Black worker. And I wanted to sort of show the development of these ideas over the course of American history, and the way they interacted with these policies and with these forms of discrimination. And so people can sort of see how their own ideas have impacted their behavior, or vice versa.
It's not a, a comfortable book, though, if you are going to find, let's say that you're an, a liberal-minded African-American and you are going to this book to see all of your ideas about racism confirmed, you won't find comfort here, because you're not just talking about white racism in this book. You also take on racial ideas held by people of color. Why do that? Do you feel as though it's necessary to include everybody?
Well, I did it because it's part of the history. And, you know, as a scholar, as an historian, I wanted to tell the complete story. And ideas are ideas. And so anybody can hold ideas that Black people are criminals, that we should fear Black people. And even Black people hold those ideas, even though there's no evidence that supports it. And so I wanted to chronicle, so everyone who believes that there's something wrong with Black people could recognize that those ideas are not only racist ideas, but those ideas are false.
Let's examine at least one of those sort of category of racist ideas among African Americans. And you talk in there about the civil rights movement and this idea that if whites see Blacks uplifting themselves, it'll improve the overall opinion of the race. The idea of the good Black. Right? That you see as a racist idea that was held by a lot of African Americans during the 1960s and 70s. Why did that idea arise, and why did it take hold?
Well, white abolitionists in the 1790s started seeing the emergence of free Blacks, and they basically started lecturing those free Blacks that if they uplift themselves and defy stereotypes, then they will persuade away the racist ideas of whites. And a certain segment of Black America took hold of that strategy and has passed it on till this day. The reason why it's a racist idea is very simple, because it suggests that Black people are responsible for the racist ideas that white people have about them. And to suggest that Black people are responsible for the racist ideas whites have is to suggest that there's some truth in notions of Black inferiority. And to believe there's some truth in notions of Black inferiority is to hold racist ideas.
So what is the difference then? And I ask you all these questions. The book answers them all and answers them really readably. But what is the difference between a racial idea and discrimination?
So, you know, going back to the initial example, if I, as a small business owner, have a job opening, and a Black person comes in to apply, and I think that that Black person is lazy merely because of the color of their skin, that's a racist idea. But then, let's say that person applies, and I hire them because I don't want to be sued. I'm not engaging in a racist practice, but other business owners may decide not to hire that person because of the color of their skin. That's a racist policy, or that's racial discrimination.
Okay, so let's go back then to what drove you to write this book. And I want to play you a comment. One of our producers went to the National Center for Civil and Human Rights here in Atlanta and asked people who were there on their thoughts on racism. So here is one Atlanta resident who blames technology for it.
My name is Saida Ogbemudia. I'm 24 years old. To me, racism is, it's not growing, it's always been there, and it's just being more and more exposed with the addition of social media. And I mean, just read the YouTube section. I mean, the comments in the YouTube section, it's more and more people, they're coming out of the woodworks because they feel more bold with technology.
And you write in your preface, I think it was, that you were driven to write this book because of all of the killings, the police-involved shootings and killings. Here she is saying that it sounds like what she's saying is that racism is as bad as it ever has ever been. We're just seeing more of it. What do you make of that?
So, you know, that's something that I had to think about as I was writing this history. And I came to realize that there has been racial progress over the course of American history, but there's been a simultaneous progression of racism. And I chronicled both. And so American history has both histories happening simultaneously.
Then let's hear one more comment that was gathered during at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. This is Nia Daniel, who is an Atlanta-based filmmaker. And here she is with her thoughts of, the origins.
Hi, I'm Thomas Elliott. When you look at the term race, it denotes a competition. And so when you're born and you're put in a particular race, that automatically puts you in on a team that has to win. So we're automatically pitted against one another. So I feel like if we're gonna wipe out racism, we have to wipe out the term race. We're a people. We're not just different races trying to compete to win.
And you actually start tracing the history of racial ideas in America back to Europe. And what do we know about the very beginnings of racist ideas?
So, yeah, the beginning of racist ideas was in 15th century Portugal. The Portuguese were the first nation, European nation to start exclusively slave trading in African people. And because they started exclusively slave trading in African people, they needed a justification, specifically before the Pope. And that justification became racist ideas. These people were beasts, these people were uncivil, and we're going to civilize them.
And then as we're walking through your book, you have separated it with tour guides. You focused on certain people, Cotton Mather, Thomas Jefferson, William Lloyd Garrison, W.E.B. Du Bois, and then finally Angela Davis to sort of walk us through this history. And why do we begin with Cotton Mather?
Well, first and foremost, Cotton Mather was the most influential theologian and preacher in early America, or I should say colonial America. He was a pastor at the North Church, which was the most prestigious church in New England. And first and foremost, he was a theologian, and science was theology, and science and theology was science in the 1600s and early 1700s. And so first, he was at the forefront of scientific ideas as a theologian. And then secondly, he was in the midst of this debate over whether Black people could become Christian. And so you had slave owners saying that no, they were too beasts, they were too barbaric to become Christians. And then you had preachers like Cotton Mather saying, no, they actually can become Christians. But the way he went about it was to say that though our bodies may be unequal, in other words, Black bodies are unequal and should be enslaved, our souls are equal. And that if Black people become Christians, their souls will become white.
And then what does that mean? Because, imagine that people are would look down the table of contents in your book and say, wait, where's Frederick Douglass? Where's Martin Luther King Jr.? Why does Cotton Mather then become, that idea, then become pivotal?
Well, he was in the midst of the pivotal debate, right? And that debate over whether Black people could become Christian. And so that was a very pivotal debate during his time period. And it really created this division between racist ideas. One group saying that Black people were permanently inferior and could not become human, because to become human was to become Christian. And then there were Cotton Mather who were saying, no, they can become, they are inferior right now, but they have the capacity to rise and become civilized. And, later in the book, I do talk about Frederick Douglass and his racist ideas. I do talk about King, when he suggested that God is white. And so, but during Cotton Mather's time period, he was this pivotal force in the debate between racist ideas.
We're speaking with Ibram Kendi. He's author of the book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And he's speaking tonight at the Atlanta History Center. Now, Cotton Mather, that idea of whether or not African-Americans could become Christian leads us almost directly to Thomas Jefferson and the founding of the country. So what is built into, our founding documents that relates to racist ideas? How did that become part of our very creation?
Well, first and foremost, of course, you had many of the writers of the founding documents were slave owners. and many of the slave owners in America, in colonial America, and then ultimately the United States, were defending slavery through racist ideas, saying that Black people should be enslaved because they're so uncivilized, or because they were cursed, they're descendants of Ham and they were cursed, or whatever idea that suggested that they should be enslaved. But then the actual Constitution itself, of course, many people are familiar with the Three-Fifths Clause, in which, for population purposes, enslaved Africans could be part of the population in the South. But the way that sort of operated was you had one group of people that stated that Black people were permanently three-fifths in terms of inferior to those five-fifths white humans. And then you had another group that would say that, yes, Black people are three-fifths right now, but we have the capacity to civilize them. And that was really the heart of the debate, and that has been the heart of the debate about racist ideas throughout the course of American history.
So I want to play you a comment from Kathleen Cleaver, who's now a lecturer at Emory University, but she was a member of the original Black Panther Party. And what she's talking about is, yes, how much progress has been made, but also how slow it has gone. Take a listen.
We attracted a lot of very, very intense people to fight for our freedom. The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War and gave Black people the right to vote. In the 60s, we're having a voting rights movement, okay? So America is very slow about recognizing what Blacks are entitled to, and particularly in the South, they want to undo and unroll and push back.
So this is one of the threads throughout your book, is the slow progress. Why is it so slow? What holds back the fight against racist ideas?
Well, because racist ideas, or I should say racist policies, benefit people. And so racist ideas, I show, have long been put to use to defend racist policies. So I just talked about how some of the founding fathers were slave owners and how they deployed racist ideas to defend slavery. Well, slavery was very beneficial for them economically. They, you know, a lot of people became very rich as a result of this institution. And so for those people, they did not want to give up this institution, right? They had to go to war, right, in order to end slavery, because slavery was so economically viable. And there have been many other policies in American history, racist policies, that have been very economically or even politically or even culturally viable for people. And so that's why they have not wanted to give them up.
Okay, so I'm going to play a comment from a speech that you actually took issue with, and this is our current president, Barack Obama, but this one is from March of 2008, and he delivered what was considered a major speech about race in America. And here's the section that you refer to in your book.
To wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding. This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years.
What problem do you have with that?
So I'm not really sure exactly what he's talking about, but what I suspect he was talking about was that basically you have white Americans saying that there are things wrong with Black people. And, you know, why is it? Because essentially you have a scenario in which you have these racial disparities and inequities. And there's only two causes of a racial disparity. Either there's something wrong with Black people or there's racial discrimination. And you have Black people fighting against racial discrimination. And then you have some white people saying, well, no, that's not the real problem. The real problem is what's wrong with Black people, which to me are racist ideas. And so I talk about the ways in which those racist ideas are just not true, and have been usually disproven. And so I think that that's what he's referring to, and that's why I had a problem with it.
I'm speaking with Ibram Kendi. He's author of the book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And he'll speak about that at the Atlanta History Center at 8:00. And I also wanted to say congratulations, because you just won a National Book Award.
Yeah, it's quite exciting. But at the same time, it's kind of unfortunate, because I know one of the reasons why you know, the book won is because race and racism is still such a prevailing issue in our society, and people are searching for ways to understand what this nation is facing.
Yeah.
But more importantly, people are searching for ways, hopefully, to eliminate this problem.
And move forward. Ibram Kendi, thank you so much. And we wanted to say thank you to Atlanta teenager Jason Crichton for gathering the responses that you heard from the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. Jason's a reporter for Vox Teen Communication. Thank you so much, Ibram.
All right. Thank you, Celeste.
Beware of scammers this holiday season, almost every holiday season. Phone callers saying they represent Georgia Power have been asking customers for billing information. They claim to be Georgia Power reps, but they're not. With me by phone to discuss this is Georgia Power Media Representative Craig Bell, and he is a legitimate representative of the power company, I think, Craig, right?
Good morning, Celeste. I am definitely a legitimate representative of the power company.
Okay. So why, first of all, can we just start with why do we get usually an uptick in scams like this in the holidays? Why the holidays?
Well, you know, the holidays, we believe, is that the fact that people are out shopping, they're out looking for deals, and we're being inundated with deals from everywhere. So for a scammer, if I had to put myself in the mindset of a scam artist, I would think that they would think this is probably an easier time that you would catch people who are receiving unexpected communications more frequently. And, you know, that just lends itself to the opportunity for you to be caught off guard by someone saying that, hey, your power bill is due right now, and if you don't pay right now, we're going to cut you off. But just know that Georgia Power would never take that type of attack with any of our customers.
Okay, you just kind of gave us a hint of what's been happening, but Georgia Power began to get some complaints about this. How does the scam work?
Well, this particular version of the scam works like someone calls your phone number or they send you a message telling you to call an 800 number. You call that 800 number. You talk to a representative who claims to be from Georgia Power, and they tell you that, hey, basically, if you don't pay your bill right now, we're going to cut your lights off. And that's just not how we operate at Georgia Power.
Is that also happening online? Are people receiving these kind of emails as well?
Yeah, people were receiving emails, basically saying the same thing, asking you to contact a number or asking you to email your personal information to Georgia Power. We would never do that. We have all of our customers' personal information on file. We would never generate an email to you stating that your power bill was past due and that you need to pay immediately or you'd be cut off. Now, what we will do at Georgia Power, we will reach out to the primary account holder's primary number and leave you a phone message or give you an automated call to call a number. But when you call in, it'll be directed into the Georgia Power Customer Service Center. We'll also send you that in the mail as well, stating that you need to call in to talk and discuss your bill. But even when you do that, we're going to offer you ways to pay that bill, to set up payment arrangements. We'll never demand a payment immediately on the spot, or we're going to cut you off.
Okay. So let me just kind of repeat back what you just said. If I am in arrears on my bill and Georgia Power does need to reach me, I know it's a legitimate contact because you're going to call and leave a message on my phone number and not ask me for my personal information.
Absolutely. And you'll call right into our customer service center, which is located here in Georgia, in Henry County. And we'll go through a series of, you know, asking you for some personal information, but it's not anything that would raise red flags with any of our customers. Primarily, we can get that just by asking what your account number is. That's verification enough for us.
Does Georgia Power ever send emails asking me for information?
No, ma'am. It's either through a phone call or we send out a letter in the mail.
Okay. Then let's move on from a little bit from these scams, which seem to have been happening more, and ask how far in arrears do I have to be before Georgia Power would cut off my power? Because that's what people are worried about, right?
Yeah, we typically at this point, if you're in arrears, I think it's about 2 to 3 months behind before we start, or excuse me, 2 months behind before we start saying that, hey, we need to make some sort of arrangements on your account. Even then, we help you at that point to come up with a payment arrangement that allows your bill to stay on. We're not just going to call you, you know, out of the blue one day and say that your bill is behind, and then within the next 5 minutes, we're going to cut you off if you don't make a payment.
It's a month-long process before you would ever lose your power.
Yes, ma'am. And, you know, and that's why, you know, we've been so proactive in teaming with the Attorney General's office. You know, we've seen seen, again, this scam in various forms. You know, before, at one point, people were coming to our customers' doors as representing themselves as Georgia Power reps at the door saying the same thing.
People would show up at their doors with a clipboard and a T-shirt or whatever that says Georgia Power is what you're saying.
Yes, ma'am. And we just don't do that. We will not do that. And even if that even if a rep comes to your house asking about, you know, your power lines or something like that, you know, they're going to have a badge. They're going to have the proper identification, and they'll give you the number that you can call in to verify. Or you could just always call, you know, the 800 number for Georgia Power. And if you still are in doubt about that, we urge any of our customers to call the police.
Okay, so if I get a phone call from one of these scammers trying to get my information, or if I get an email, what do I do with it?
Delete the email. Don't reply to it. If you get a phone call, hang up and immediately call us at our 800 number.
Okay, great. Craig Bell is a media representative for Georgia Power. We've been talking about scams. Georgia Power has been fighting this one itself, but as you heard, also in conjunction with the Attorney General's Office of Georgia. Callers have been posing as Georgia Power collectors. They are not Georgia Power collectors. Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste, for your time.
Construction recently began on the future headquarters of the U.S. Army's Cyber Command Facility. It'll be based at Fort Gordon, right outside Augusta. The state-of-the-art center will bring many new intelligence and security jobs with it. Last year, I talked about the project and its impact on the local community with Tom Tuckey. At the time, he was executive director of the CSRA Alliance for Fort Gordon. It's a coalition of business leaders and elected officials in the central Savannah River area. We also spoke with Jeff Carney, the associate superintendent in the Columbia County School System. I started by asking Tom how many people are expected to move to the area.
Well, the growth of the intelligence missions at Fort Gordon really started in 2013, and over the next 3 or 4 years, coupled with what's already happened, we will expect to have about 4,000 new civilian and military employees on the installation itself. Using the military models, that equates to about 10,000 new people coming into the community when you factor in spouses and children. So we anticipate, just for the growth at Fort Gordon, to see about 10,000 new faces, as you said, coming into the community.
And this affects not just the city of Augusta, but the surrounding counties as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. About two-thirds of the children of employees at Fort Gordon today currently attend schools in the Columbia County School District. So it really affects the entire region, and it also stretches across the river into North Augusta and South Carolina.
So how do you prepare for such huge, massive growth when most cities have trouble even handling growth on a much slower scale?
Well, we clearly understand that there's some areas that we have to really address immediately, and those are the road transportation and the school systems. Those we think are going to have the biggest impact. And so we actually started working with the Department of Transportation about 2 years ago on how to relieve some of the congestion in and around the installation itself, as well as the primary routes for folks to get to the installation. Both the Richmond County and Columbia County school districts have been working this for a while, and they understand that they're facing significant growth and have already taken a lot of steps to work towards that. And I think Jeff can probably address that.
Well, thank you. Let's bring Jeff into this conversation, because, Jeff, I understand that already some of the schools are over capacity. You're obviously expecting even more students to arrive. Are you going to have to build new schools?
Absolutely. We have, just in the next 5 years, at least five schools on a plan to build either brand new schools to accommodate some of this growth, or we're doing tear downs of old schools and building them bigger when they're new.
So do you have any idea how many total students you might end up by 2019?
We don't have a clear-cut number. We're guessing between 3,000 and 5,000. So as they come, we grew about 620 kids this year. We're expecting just a conservative estimate of about 720 next year. So it's just hard to say. Fort Gordon can't tell us an exact number because it's a gradual shift of employees down to this area. So they can't really tell us exactly how many are coming every year.
And Tom, I wonder, I mean, that's a lot of parents dropping kids off. And already there are issues dealing with traffic, not just in the city of Augusta, but in the surrounding area. Are we talking building new roads? Are they going to have to widen roads? What's going to happen with traffic?
Well, this region was one of the regions that passed the Transportation Investment Act, and so we are now benefiting from funds through the Department of Transportation to do a lot of road projects. And a lot of those projects that are under construction today will, in fact, relieve a lot of the congestion. It's a lot of road widening. It's not necessarily all new roads. It's mostly improving the existing roads. And then the number one project that we're working at the installation is the construction of a new gate. And the location that's been selected for that gate is such that it's farther onto the installation, and it allows the stacking of vehicles on the installation itself instead of on the main thoroughfares leading to the installation, which should relieve a lot of the congestion.
Oh, I see. Around. While they're waiting to get onto the base,
exactly.
They're not clogging up the road.
Exactly. And I think another, since we're talking about adding people and congestion, I think something that needs to be factored in is that we haven't been able to get our arms around yet is the fact that this is going to be, as we refer to it, the Silicon Valley for Army cybersecurity. And anything and everything that has to do with Army cybersecurity is going to happen in the Augusta region. And what that means is that we are going to attract a ton of defense contractors to this area who are in that business, whether they're already a defense contractor, a wannabe defense contractor, or they just want to be here because this is going to be the heartbeat of cybersecurity. And so those numbers have to be factored in as well, because that's going to bring thousands more into the community, and we don't know what those numbers are going to be. I mean, I've talked to some defense contractors that right now have offices as small as 3, and I've talked to another that's bringing over 100. So
and let's hope that they have really good internet connections, right? Because
well, they will. That's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons that all of these missions are coming here is because of the data pipes that that exist in this region.
So let me go to you, Jeff, because as I understand it, you know, we're talking about the becoming the Silicon Valley of the East. And I understand that means that you're also considering changes to curriculum, even in the K-12 areas.
Absolutely. In fact, we worked with Richmond County and the folks at Fort Gordon to develop a series of courses. So when a kid graduates from high school, they have a good chance of getting an entry-level job out at NSA or at Fort Gordon.
And, I mean, how does that function in the day-to-day life? When would a kid start learning? What grade are they in when they start learning about cybersecurity?
This is really geared more towards high school. They could start their 9th or 10th grade year with a digital technology course, and then a cybersecurity course, and then advanced cybersecurity. And it ends with an internship at NSA.
You do realize, Jeff, that, you know, you're training little hackers.
Absolutely.
That's correct.
and the Army wants us to. It's a different kind of kid that this is geared towards. It's not necessarily your valedictorian or your smartest kid. It's sort of the kid that spends a lot of time on computers by themselves, the gamer types. That's what they're looking for, and that's what this pathway is geared towards. I don't know that it will hit a large number of kids. It's just a particular kind of kid that they're looking for.
I mention that just because if you're training a high school full of hackers, you might want to look into the security of your own county school websites and... You know.
Oh, we worry about that.
That's all factored into the effort. And our next effort in the education arena is to work on the 6th, 7th, and 8th graders and to get them prepared to move into that cybersecurity
right.
pathway when they reach high school. And one of the reasons that we want to get to them that early is we need to get to them before they get in trouble.
Right.
If any of these kids get caught shoplifting or smoking marijuana or anything like that, they have basically taken them out of any opportunity to pursue employment in that field because they'll never be able to get a security clearance.
Even if you're a minor, anything on your record,
minor,
even as a minor?
It depends on how serious an offense it is, but it could, in fact, prevent you from getting any kind of a security clearance. It is getting very tough. The Eric Snowdens of the world have made it very tough
right.
on anybody to pursue that has anything in their background.
Because they're looking at people assuming they're going to take all their data and leave and go to Russia.
Well, a big part of the cybersecurity training is the importance of being honest and in the integrity of the whole thing. That's kind of the first whole phase of the training is we're not teaching you this so that you can go out and be a hacker and do things illegally.
Right.
The morality of it plays a major role in the whole training process.
Well, let's go back to just some a few broader issues, because that cybersecurity curriculum is fascinating. And I know we're going to want to check back in when you're actually teaching some classes right. in this. But I wanted to talk about Augusta suddenly becoming, you know, a city with well over 200,000 residents and all the different things that that means. Are there enough homes? Are there enough different socioeconomic prices for homes? Is there enough rentals? Tom, is Augusta and that surrounding area really going to be ready for that influx of people?
Well, I think another factor that enter into all of these decisions, I mean, the primary factor was the synergy created by assigning these missions to Fort Gordon because of what was already at Fort Gordon. But another factor that certainly played in this is the economics of the region and the low cost of living, the low cost of housing. Today, it's a buyer's market still. But each year there are more and more houses being sold. There are, I don't know how many new developments under construction today to accommodate all of this projected growth and to prepare for all these folks. So I think the number of houses is not going to be an issue, because I think the realtors and the developers are working very hard to make sure that they can accommodate this growth.
And
so
what about?
I think we're okay there. And you know, we already recognize that we're a cost of housing 8% below the national average. So. It's a popular place for folks to come, and that's one of the attractions and why people want to come here.
And Jeff, just in the quickly, do you have enough teachers, or are you going to have to hire a whole bunch more teachers?
We anticipate hiring more. We're blessed in that regard because of our standing in the state. We generally don't have a problem hiring teachers. A lot of people in our area they gravitate towards Columbia County, so we welcome that kind of growth.
That's Jeff Carney, the associate superintendent in the Columbia County School System. We also heard from Tom Tuckey, who was the executive director of the CSRA Alliance for Fort Gordon. I spoke to both of them last year. And that's our show for today, but tomorrow we talk about hidden histories in Georgia. Do you know something about history that you think should be heard by more people? Call and tell us about it at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.